Welcome to the Talking Writing Podcast. I'm John Vogel, TW's creative director. Today's guest is author and musician Antonio Michael Downing, whose novel Black Cherokee was released in August by Simon & Schuster. The book is the coming-of-age story of Ophelia Blue Rivers, grappling with her identity and trying to fit into different settings in South Carolina. As an industry titan pollutes the river on which her reservation relies, Ophelia's life is upended by the fight against encroaching colonialism. Antonio Michael's previous book, Saga Boy, is a memoir about growing up in Trinidad, moving to snowy Canada as a child to live with his Auntie Joan, who worked with the northern indigenous populations, and his entry into music in the punk hip-hop group Gen Militia and as his pop persona, John Orpheus. The music in this episode comes from his John Orpheus song, Fella Awoke.
Fella Awoke, the day they killed his mother, and told her heart had guided him like no other. Then the soldiers came with their boots and their guns, while the children played in the yard one by one. They threw a body from a window, and the soul took flight. They broke fella's face, broke fella's arm, broke his heart with that sight. Mama, I'ma miss you, and your oceans of smiles, I will miss you.
First off, in Black Cherokee, the story is set in South Carolina on a Cherokee reservation, and I tried to look it up on the map to see if there was anything there. Is there a real place that it's... I was also surprised because my parents live in Rock Hill, and there's Rock Hill Road in the story. And I was like, is this like right near my parents' house? But it looks like it's more of a fictitious setting. Did you have a specific place that it was based on?
Yes. And you found the only clue that I left in about where it's at. So the town that they go to and that she lives in and the church is in and that she goes to high school in, that's based on Rock Hill.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yeah. But I kind of left that little hint in there for people that knew. But I thought no one's ever going to get that. But apparently I was wrong. You are the first.
Nice. What is your, do you have a family down there, or like what's your association with the area?
I was spending a lot of time. At one point in my life, in my corporate life, I worked for BlackBerry.
Right.
So my territory was the South, and basically I worked with AT&T in the South. So I was, you know, everywhere in the South, in the Panhandle, New Orleans, Mississippi, Florida, Georgia, and the Carolinas, of course. And I spent a lot of time in that area, in the Charlotte and suburbs area a lot. And as a result, I had friends in Rock Hill, and so I would spend a lot of time there. And as a result, I kind of got inspired by the landscape around there, but also the history around there. So there's a point where Ophelia is biking to school, and she passes this house called the White House. And it's on White Road, and it's actually a house that has a plaque in front of it that says, hey, this is where Southern soldiers would come for a respite or convalescence, and we would take care of them. Now, that place actually exists in Rock Hill. It's called it's called the White House. It's on White Road, and they use it now as like a venue for weddings, but that was a big part of the genesis of the book, because coming to the South as like, you know, I'm from the South Trinidad, but I'm also from the North Canada. What shocked me was how everybody was living in these currents of history, but people didn't necessarily know the history. But if you walk around the towns, the history is right there in front of you. And I just thought, wow, that's so interesting that they're commemorating the side that lost in a town where half the people were not cheering for that side. So I was like, wow, that's interesting. And it, mm-hmm. it was also a town where up until maybe, I think, 2008, the high schools hadn't really been integrated. There was a black oh, wow. high school and a white high school. And then, so while I was going there, I was seeing that and I was going, wait a minute, isn't this stuff supposed to be over?
right.
And what you learned is that history is never over. And I think that's a huge theme in Black Cherokee and that I took out of the inspiration of going there. But I'm so happy, John, that you actually caught that it was Rock Hill, because no one in all the interviews I've done has even mentioned it.
Nice.
But yeah, you nailed it. That is the real place that the town Stone River is based on. And the general vicinity is where I based the Indian reservation, which is really a creation of my own. Although I will say it's fictitious, but it's based on a lot of research of things that actually happened. So the Eastern Band of Cherokee, which is based just south of the Great Smoky Mountains, just across the border, in North Carolina, but just south of the Great Smoky, so toward right. Going west, that's their story of how they ended up not doing the Trail of Tears is similar to this band that I have fictitiously created, just as a platform to talk about these issues of, you know, having these cross lineages. But again, you know, everything else, like the Black Freedmen is a real thing. The Cherokee are the only one of the five tribes that have accepted them in as full members. And that was in 2019, so very recently.
Wow.
So all the history is real, although it's a fictitious story. But also, yes, it comes out of me going to that area where your parents live and seeing how the history was interplaying and living. And you know, it's never over. It's never mm-hmm. over. And that vibe is what inspired Black Cherokee.
Nice. And I did want to go over the history of, because you have the experience of living in Canada with your Auntie Joan on the Sioux Reservation. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of your personal experience of her work with the native population of Canada mm-hmm. that you've sort of like transplanted down into the United States and into the Southern United States, which is particular. I wanted to hear like what of your experience from that time period did you bring into the story, and like what how did that play into it?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, when you say Black Cherokee, the name of the book, right away it creates this tension, right? Because you're like, these things do not normally go together, right? Indigenous and Black. We know both of them, but we don't know them as one thing. Growing up in Trinidad, though, I did. All the Indigenous people I met as a kid were mixed with Black. They were Afro-Indigenous. The Caribbean is called the Caribbean because of the Carib Indians, who were the original settlers of the region, one of the original settlers. So, mm-hmm. so I guess that's the first thing I'd say, is that it's not really transposing Indigenous history into America. We have to remember that this was all one thing once mm-hmm. upon a time. So if you go to a powwow in Thunder Bay, Ontario, which is on Lake Superior, if you know your Midwest Great Lakes geography, and then you go to one in Michigan, it's the same powwow.
Right.
It's the same people, right? Because yeah. that border is not their border.
Right.
So that doesn't extend down into the South. Because, of course, you know, it's different tribes, different nations. But I said it there because of my connection to the region from touring there and being about there and realizing I could see clearly that all these histories were happening. And so I guess what I'd say is growing up in Trinidad around Afro-Indigenous people, going to Canada and seeing more Indigenous people who weren't Afro-Indigenous but Indigenous, it kind of made me sensitive to those issues and kind of aware that these people weren't dead like the cowboys in Indian movies want us to believe. Like, you know, so much of those movies I saw as a kid was just them being slaughtered. And so I came to North America thinking, well, they're gone. And it's like, nah, they ain't gone. They're still here. And so when I was in the South, I suddenly realized, whoa, there are histories that are overlapping. And I saw signs of it. I became very sensitive to it. And it made me, and the fact that no one, the fact that everybody's lives were being influenced by the history that was still alive, and yet no one actually knew the history, that made me, that was really interesting to me. And so I thought, you know, why are there no Indigenous people when originally this was all their space, right? So how did they get out of the Southeast? And of course, the story is an American president misbehaving, which never happens. Andrew Jackson passed the Indian Removal Act and forced them all to march to Oklahoma, which is where their descendants are today, that area. And of course, many of them died. This is the famous Trail of Tears. Right. And so because I guess the remnants of encountering Indigenous people so early in my life made me sensitive to the fact that, oh, wait a minute, these folks are around and they're part of the history. So when I saw the history being not there, but there, like Succotash, like in Black Cherokee, you see the history in a lot of the food. Succotash right. is a combination of European, African, and Indigenous, like, ingredients. And I'm like, okay, well, Southern people are all eating succotash, but one of the contributors to that food is not here. So what happened? You know, and that's part of what interested me in writing about this. Sorry, that's a whole podcast of an answer right there.
No, all good. Speaking of the history, there's like a theme of colonialism in Saga Boy that you bring up several times, but most of the colonialism in that book like stems from how it interacts with your own internal life, like the internalization of the colonialism that you experienced growing up. And then in Black Cherokee, I feel like the colonialism is much more of a social presence where there's like things happening in real life to the population because of the ongoing colonial effort of basically, you know, business and white people taking over the land and polluting the river. So very much more like physical and external. I don't have a good way to like ask a question around that, but I just wanted to see if you could go over how you feel like you were exploring those two themes differently in the two books.
Yeah, well, I think you found, John, a big connection between Saga Boy, my memoir, and Black Cherokee, my first full-length novel. It's like, I think, you know, Saga Boy starts with this line, "The Queen designed my brain."
Right, and it ends with something along those lines.
And it ends with the same line, yes, it does. Yes. Spoiler alert. But, you know, and it's a pun between my grandmother being the queen, but also the actual real queen, because when I went to school as a kid, actually the first white person I ever met was the queen in this one room schoolhouse and we're all sort of Indian and West African. But there she is, Gloriana Regina, up on the wall, staring down at us beneficently. And then when I got to Canada, I said I went to the first high school I went to was called Queen Elizabeth District High School. And I walked into the foyer and there she is staring down at me again. And so I kind of had Saga Boy is about me kind of going, well, how do I figure out myself? And then I was like, well, I got to figure out my parents to figure out myself. And then, okay, well, how do I figure out my parents? Well, I got to figure out their parents. And then I was like, oh, well, how do I figure them out? And then I had to ask the question, well, what are these West African people doing on a little island off of South America? Like, mm-hmm. literally, like off the coast of Venezuela is literally where Trinidad is. And that led to the fact that my entire life, although I didn't understand it, and I don't think anyone really does, because that's how history works. Again, my entire life is shaped by forces that I did not understand, that I could not see, but was all around me at the exact same time, right? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. it's kind of like you live it and you're just living your life as a kid. And then suddenly you look back and go, yeah, how come there were no white folks there, but the queen was sitting looking down on me at school every day? Like, it's a mystery, right? And so that idea of being in Saga Boy, it's a personal story of me being personally caught up in history I didn't understand. In Black Cherokee, it's again a more broader story of America and of people of these particular lineages in America being caught up in history that's affecting their life, but they don't understand because, you know, like, for example, the guys who pollute the river, mm-hmm. you know, they turn out to be, you know, it's kind of this idea. Derrida has this idea of hauntology, which is where time just collapses. Like, there's no time is an illusion because we're always haunted by the past and the future. So mm-hmm. in the poisoning of the river, you have the history of that family who owned the farm. Is part, it has an entwined history with Ophelia. And then the young guy who ends up inheriting all of that, he has a future history with Ophelia. You mm-hmm. see what I mean? Mm-hmm. So suddenly you're caught up in the in this undertow of all this history that no one understands, but it's right in front of you. And I think that's what Saga Boy and Black Cherokee have in common, except with Saga Boy, it's my story. But with Black Cherokee, in a lot of ways, you could read it as an allegory of America's story, because mm-hmm. the people that created America are all present. And it's almost like a time warp back to that time where they were all interacting and creating the history. But now we're in the future and it's all sort of happening at once. It's like the history is haunting the present and the mm-hmm. future. Everyone's hopes for the future is also haunting the present. So so I think it's more clear in Black Cherokee, that concept of time just not mattering, you know, of all the things interacting. But in Saga Boy, it's more personal, but it's also, I'm still getting, you know, it's the same theme, but I think in Saga Boy, I'm just discovering how important it is to my life. And in Black Cherokee, I'm understanding how important it is to everyone's lives, really. Like, we all have, you know, lineages of our body, our family, our town, our country. You know, we all have those lineages and we're swimming in it. And so few people actually understand, like, oh, you know, few people ask, how did it get this way? But really, you don't have to ask too many questions to like I did in Saga Boy, watch it all unravel back to things that seem distant, but are actually very present. Mama, I'ma miss you. And your oceans of smiles, I will miss you. And the sun's in your eyes, Mama, I'ma miss you. Like the red Mr. Plibs, yeah, I will miss you. Until I see you again. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you a question about, and this is going to take a while to set up, about race and musical style, because because this comes in, you were in like a rap punk band, and you were very into heavy metal growing up,
yeah,
which is actually like super predominantly white, but it like triggered in my mind a couple other instances of people that I've read recently, specifically read or listened to. Specifically, Hanif Adurakib. Do you know him, the writer?
Yeah. In fact, if you pan over in that corner, there's a big poster of both him and I from a talk we did last year. So, yes, nice. I do know Hanif.
he says in one of his books that he talks a lot about being in the like Ohio early punk pop punk scene,
right,
and getting really into like Fall Out Boy, but also feeling like the only black person there, like being pretty out of place. And I also read the biography of Faith No More recently, and Billy Gold. Yeah, I'm a huge Faith No More fan. And Billy Gold, the bass player, said that he was, before Faith No More, he was in a band that was doing punk music, but he was the only white person in the group. But audiences didn't really like get it, because they were like, you're not supposed to, you don't look right, you know, you're not supposed to like be playing this music, and it just makes
God.
and me as you know, I love heavy metal, heavy music and rock and electronic music and classical music, but I also like a lot of rap, jazz, and soul. So it makes me question like sort of like the authenticity, or like what feels right when you're making music, and how it interacts with race, and how audience members will perceive that, and whether you feel like you're in the right place doing that, you know? And since you have grown up with multiple styles and also been in bands that sort of mix those styles, I was wondering if you had like a take on that interaction and how it's played a role in your life and your music.
Oh yeah, man, John, we could do a whole podcast on that. It's my life. Like, I lived that vibe because I coming from Trinidad, I didn't know you weren't supposed to like certain things.
Right.
So I just liked everything. I was like Guns N' Roses, Metallica, Meg. I'm like, that sounds great. And I was listening to all the hip hop and R&B and stuff too. In fact, but there was, you know, so I guess here's the first thing I'll say. As you know, John, genres are marketing categories that record companies make up, because it allows them to sell not only records, but lifestyles, you know, clothes, and a whole suite of products around it. But really, music is about how does that make you feel? And the whole thing about race and music, I always found ridiculous, because, I mean, well, who invented rock and roll?
Oh, right. Yeah, no,
right?
The appropriation angle of, like, how much has been taken, yeah.
Yeah, sure. Like, to me, I mean, I don't even think of it like that. I mean, I believe that music is a way too fluid thing to not be shared. Like, it's like you can't contain it to small communities, because it's just too potent, and it's supposed to. So I don't even think of it as appropriation, but I do kind of chafe at the idea that now that white folks are playing rock music, I can't.
Right.
You know, like, that seems really weird. And a lot of people said to me, just like they said to you, hey, man, you're not the right color to be doing that music you're doing. And it works with class, too, where people might say, you're a poor kid, what are you doing listening to classical? You know? So it's more than, it's bigger than race. What it is that people, because music is so powerful, people take it and claim it as ways of separating people and saying, well, you listen to this, therefore you're that kind of person. And so it's used as a great tool for division, But, you know, of course, especially musicians, famously, we listen to everything. If you're a music dude, music person, you don't care about those things. You're more interested in, hey, what does that sound like? How does it make me feel? Like, I like that vibe. And so we've all listened to all the things. I've had encounters with every kind of music because I'm curious about it. So my take on it is that I love, you know, my life has been claiming back spaces that people are saying, well, you don't belong in. And, you know, forget going back to Chuck Berry and Little Richard and Ike Turner. I mean, there were very prominent Black musicians in the founding of punk and hardcore. I mean, Bad Brains, for example, right? So, you know, or Living Color in the 80s was kind of
Living Color and Fishbone, I feel like.
For sure. And so for me, and also a heavy Latino American presence in a lot of heavy music and indigenous. Right, right. Like I listened to an all indigenous band called Death Angel when back in the day when I was into that stuff. And you know, and so it's a kind of erasure to say, oh, you're not allowed to do this thing that people who look like you were always involved in and created and were instrumental in making. It's like, but that's, you know, generally writ large, if you're talking Black and white in America, I mean, that's the story of every American art form. Is that it usually starts with major contributions by Black folk, and then it gets sort of moves into the general population, and then, you know, you can make a lot of money off of it, and once the corporate interests take over, suddenly it stops being Black, and it starts being this other thing. Like, if you look at, you know, the top 10 best-selling jazz musicians, guess what? You know, if you look, same thing with rock, a lot of with hip hop as well. Like, you know, hip hop has kind of stayed, but you know, there are hip hop festivals all over the world now because hip hop's internationalized, where there's no Black artists at any of them, you know, and it speaks to the power of the music, but also it speaks to the idea that we would like the Black thing without the Black people.
Like, right, right.
I was babysitting my nieces, and they're 9 and 7, and they love K-pop, and so they were watching this,
K-pop Demon Hunters.
Yes, K-pop Demon Hunters.
We've just gotten into it. I have a 7-year-old, so he's just gotten into it. Yeah,
yeah. So K-pop Demon Hunters, and I'm listening to songs, and first of all, I'm like, I know the difference. I'm like, these aren't just TV songs. These are real, actual musicians made these songs. These are real. Yes. And subsequently, I found out many of them had charted on Billboard. but when I was listening to them, what I heard was hip hop and like that boy band version of R&B, which started with, like, you know, New Edition and went back to the Jackson 5, and then suddenly, instead of New Edition, it became, you know, NSYNC and Backstreet Boys, because they were hey, this is great, but you know, it'd be better. Let's get rid of these Black guys and stick some cute white dudes in here. And, you know, and that's Sex in the City, right? Sex in the City is based on Living Single, which is a show about, you know, a show that everyone celebrates, and no one understands that they literally, the producers literally said, we like Living Single. It'll be better if we make this other version of it. And of course, when you think about Sex in the City, and I was unfortunate enough because of a girl I was dating once to watch all of it, like all the seasons. And there literally was one Black character. And yeah. I don't know if you've ever been to New York, but I don't know what they did with all the Black and Latino people in Sex in the City. So it's not just, let's just put some white faces in these roles. It's also, let's erase the presence of those Black faces as well. Because you could have New York City, and do a Sex in the City with white folks, but actually make it look like New York. But of course, they're not making a real New York. They're making a New York that is sanitized. And that was the K-pop thing. I thought, wow, mm-hmm. they've absolutely erased all the black presence. And a friend sent me yesterday a collection of this TV show in Poland where it's white folks doing a black American music in blackface. And it's one of the most popular shows in Poland.
Currently,
like this is okay. on now. I will send it to you. And okay. it is, and it's hilarious because they're so bad. But Poland is a country that is, you know, up until the Ukraine war prior to mm-hmm. had the most violent anti-immigration, anti like black or brown immigrants coming to our country laws. And so there's this weird thing where everyone's attracted to the culture that black people create, but then they quickly want to eliminate the black people from it. And so the idea that, so I have zero problem, I don't even think of it as appropriation, with everybody sharing the music. Mm-hmm. But I do have a problem with this kind of like, let's pretend you never had anything to do with it, because then what it means is that I can't participate in it. And same thing with you and like doing the other way, like, you know, we know about Muscle Shoals, right? There were white people at the founding of soul music. So mm-hmm. the idea that a white person can't do soul music is also kind of absurd. And so we are always doing this thing where we kind of want to turn the music into something that people can own and identify with, you know. And I just think that that's, you know, like it does a disservice to everyone by mm-hmm. doing that, because I just feel like, you know, you're a musician, John, like, you know, music is yeah. music. Like, we just want to, you know, it's all great. And so the idea that you can't participate in it is fundamentally against the whole idea of art in the first place, which is, you know, an amalgamation of who we are.
Yeah, I one thing that this whole conversation is bringing up with me is, like, I grew up in the 90s, and so I was, like, going to a lot of shows as a teenager, and mm-hmm. I would go to hip-hop shows, like, I saw, like, the Spit Kickers tour with De La Soul and Talib Kweli and Biz Markie, Kool Keith, Black Star. I saw all of those shows in like 1999, 2000. And at the time I was like the only one of only a couple white people in the audience.
Right.
And it also makes me think of, but now like I went to like Deltron 3030 a few years ago and yeah. And it was like,
I would be the one of the only black people there,
exactly.
I bet.
Yes, exactly. It was like all white dudes, you know, like right. very few women, yeah. very few people of color anywhere.
Yeah.
But I also think of it on the other side, like Nirvana is a band that I live in an area that has, you know, probably 50-60% black population mm-hmm. in my neighborhood. And I see a lot of Nirvana shirts on black people, you know, and it's like yeah. it's like obviously like this music is connecting. And I think of this one scene in a documentary about Dr. Dre where he's listening to Nirvana and just like rocking out and just like feeling yeah. it so hard. But then mm-hmm. there's another documentary called Montage of Heck where they show
yep.
the shows of Nirvana in the 90s, and it's
yep.
white, like absolutely yeah. white, you know, yeah. and it just makes me think of like how many other, you know, how much better it would be if like all the people that resonated with this music were felt comfortable yeah. about being together in the same place to enjoy it. And, you know, it just I mean, yeah. There's also a time thing happening there. But yeah, I don't know. It just makes me feel weird sometimes. I just wish there was yeah. more comfort.
Well, and yeah. there's a shift. Like, as you said, like, stuff starts over here and it shifts. And then there's a kind of, again, an erasure of where it came from, so that suddenly it's like it's not comfortable for certain people to show up at the show. Right. Like in, if you look at the foundations of hip hop, there's women all over it. Right. And there's prominent, important women all over it. And there's always been and there still is. But for some reason, it's like, you know, dudes are like going, no, this is an our thing. Whereas it really isn't. Like the music does not really belong to anyone, is what the founding of the music tells us. And I think when music starts getting to that point where it's so isolated and it's niche and it's excluding people, then I think that's when those forms die out, is because they're no longer, you know, they still continue to exist, but they don't continue to be relevant to most people. Right. Yeah. And I think that that's unfortunate, because like all music has so much to, I mean, you know, listen to what we're talking about. Like if you could actually let everything be open to everyone, then music actually has this power to put people together that might otherwise not be together, and therefore like bridge gaps between people and create friendships and create synergies where you realize, you know, like a lot of the things that people tell us that we're different and we shouldn't, you should stay away from those people, they're all nonsense, right? Like it's, we're not, you know, the whole black and white thing is so ridiculous, because at the heart of it, class is way more important than, like, I have less in common with a wealthy black person than I do with a poor white person. You know what I mean? Like we have way more in common because we probably listen to the same music, eat the same food, enjoy the same kind of comedy. That, you know, so actually the thing, and that's intentional, right? There's been a lot of scholarship around how ruling classes, you know, the idea is, there's a very famous quote by, I'm not going to remember his name, but the quote went something like this. He was like, look, if you want to control black people, all you need is some tear gas and some guns. But if you want to control white people, you need white supremacy. You need to give them something that tells them that their enemy are those people that look different, but really those people are the exact same. And when you've had real drives towards change and prosperity in the lower and middle classes, it's situations like Detroit where everyone's working at the same factory. And we realize, oh, you're not my enemy. We're on the same shift. We want the same things. We want a strong union because it's going to help both of us. And when unions were strong, you had a decrease of the disparity between rich and poor, which, you know, obviously today that's expanded and expanded and expanded. And a lot of it's because unions aren't powerful anymore. And that's because instead of seeing common goals with the people, like with other people, we're suddenly always saying, well, oh, those white people, those black people, and we're very divided. And that's not unintentional on the part of people, because if you actually could have people who actually have real affinity for each other and real sharing of culture with each other, say, hey, wait a minute, you're not my enemy, then they might actually discover that who the real enemy is, and that might be a problem for some people. So they'd love for us to be like, no, rock and roll, that's white people music, you're not allowed. And it works both ways. It's police both ways. Like, because black people were the ones who were hardest on me. Playing, you know, no one was mad at me because they didn't have to see it, but people would be like, what is wrong with you? Why are you doing that? You know? And then white people would be like, oh, what are you doing here? Like, this isn't your thing. That's so weird that you want to play guitars. And it wouldn't matter how many founders of rock that I could name who were black, that they would, it just wouldn't matter. So I think there's a deliberate thing, and the music represents culture, and the culture is a reflection of who we are, and who we are is our society that, you know, there's people who have interests in dividing us, and they're the ones who are saying things like, that's not for you, and that you shouldn't be doing that, and that's not okay, because who cares? Like, that, who cares? Like, I love all of it. Like, I was just sorting, I just got a record player behind me, you can't see it, and so I'm buying records, and I've got, like, everything from hard rock to Prince to Miles Davis to classical, and I just got into, like, vocal, medieval choral music, like,
classical,
but all, like, vocal arrangements, and I'm like, and it's beautiful, and I think that freedom is the thing that some people find threatening, and I think that's why they're always kind of going, no, you can't just do whatever, because then that makes you harder to control.
Yeah, I awoke the day grandmama had her stroke, and I cried and I cried until the tears stopped my throat. You see, she was the gardener and I was the soil. She said, boy, you got a long road, full of love but full of toil. Oh yeah, I'ma miss you, and your oceans of smiles, I will miss you.
I think of the sampling issue, especially in America, like the heavy policing of sampling to be also sort of indicative of that. Is that something that you've thought about before?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, I think, you know, when you think about the foundations of hip hop, it's literally kids who have musical airs and ambitions and talents and inclinations, but no money for music lessons to learn instruments and no actual equipment. And so literally they're creating breakbeats. It is an innovation to kind of take the part of the song that you like and reimagine it and change the rhythm. And so it came from, like many innovations in life and certainly in art and music, it came from scarcity, right? It came from not having. But again, the business of music, you know, started with, you know, producing sheet music and producing the song. So copyright works on words and lyrics, right? That's how it works on. So if you, as a songwriter, that's what you get paid on. But rhythm is obviously a form of creativity. Well, how do you copyright rhythm? We don't know. Like, we don't have a format for that. And so sampling is kind of coming out of the hip hop tradition of, look, we're going to take this piece of music and we're literally going to cut the record and just reposition it, recontextualize it. And, you know, there's lots of rules about it. And some of it favors a lot of old school black artists who get sampled a lot. And some of it, and some of it favors other artists who have created music that hip hop folks have reimagined. I feel like it could be easier to sample and share. Like, I feel like that would make it easier. But of course, music doesn't care, right? Music,
right.
Like, it hasn't stopped the creation of music. It's just people just either play it themselves or they find other ways to do it. And they move around it. Like, a lot of the Dr. Dre stuff, for example, when you was finding people like Scott Storch, for example, who's playing like the Still Dre piano, like literally he's playing that on piano, or Mike Elizondo, who did a lot of the Eminem and 50 Cent stuff. Like, so they just find people who can play it and they just play original stuff instead of sampling. And that's right. The workaround. So it's kind of like, at some point, it doesn't matter. Like, those limitations are really commercial entities imposing themselves on the music, which, again, that's a theme today. And so, but it's because that's how it works. Like, a lot of the ways we police music and do copyright, like, that has to do with the moneyed interests going, hey, we need to be able to have rules around this so that we can make money on it. you know, and very often it's not the musicians making money, but, you know, there's a social economic part of that too, because you had, you know, you had Elvis notoriously claiming a lot of writing credit for songs that he didn't write. And, you know, Led Zeppelin basically invented a whole style based on old black musicians. And, you know, there was the one case where they had to pay up, where they literally took the lyrics, took the, and they just gave it another name. And I think it was the Lemon Song. And they just gave it another name, sold 25 million, and attributed it to Page and Plant. And, you know, it's like, and, but they did that for a lot of other musics, where they took the style, they took the rhythms, and they wrote new lyrics, and they just stamped their name on it. Well, there's no way to copyright that, right? Like, you know, the only time we came closest was when Blurred Lines, remember that song?
Yeah.
I know you
want Ed Sheeran.
No, not Ed Sheeran. Another Robin Thicke.
Robin Thicke. Robin Thicke. And wait, that was the Marvin Gaye.
That was the Marvin Gaye one. Right? Yeah. I used to go out to party. Right. Yeah. So they took that groove and based this whole new song on it. And that was probably one of the only first times ever that rhythms were seen as part of copyright. And what they judged in the end was, even though the Robin Thicke song Blurred Lines had different words, different melodies, different elements, the rhythmic component was exactly the same as Marvin Gaye. So they said, you owe those guys money. And but normally it hasn't been that way. And of course, you know, coming from a European tradition, you know, like, it makes sense that sheet music, you know, that's the copyright. So not the drums or the, you know, and that's where, you know, sort of black is music influenced by African music, which is drum centric, rhythm centric. So the copyrights don't usually allow you to copyright rhythms, right? The rhythms, so the rhythms have typically been free for all. And so that moves in one direction, but the sampling is sort of the other direction, where people are like, oh, we want to sample the chords and words or this little sliver of music. And they're like, well, no, you can't do that. So it's all, you know, it's all just, again, like, it's a theme. The moneyed interests define the playing field for how we talk about sampling and copyright and who owns what and who's allowed to do what. And very frequently, like socio-political factors factor in, because, you know, come on, we're doing it with AI right now, where they're trying to decide, you know, I got a notice from the big settlement that they had with the AI company. Because they used both a couple of my books. They used Saga Boy and Black Cherokee and Stars in My Crown. They used them. They scraped them. And so there was a settlement, because we're trying to determine what is AI allowed to do. And, you know, the tech bros are saying, hey, it's too bad. You know, there's winners and losers when tech comes out. So sorry, all you content owners. You copyright owners, sorry about it. I guess you're just going to lose. And then, of course, they want copyright ownership of their intellectual property that they use other people's copyright intellectual property to create. So, again, and that's going to be decided not by fairness or justice, but by who has the most lobbyists in Washington. That's who's going to decide how that works. And so I think music and copyright and sampling is just part of that matrix, right? And as soon as money's involved, you have the business people and the lawyers come in and they go, hey, let's establish some rules that are good for us. You know, and so Sorry, that was a long thing. Now I'm not gonna apologize, but it all sort of gets deeper as soon as you step into it, right?
And I'm assuming for the AI thing, I'm assuming you didn't. Where did they scrape the text from? Because I'm assuming it wasn't something that you put out there and allowed them do.
Oh, no, John, no. These guys, the tech bros are not asking permission. And I say that as a partial insider, having worked it for BlackBerry for 10 plus years. So a lot of my friends are tech bros. But and yeah, they're not asking permission. Profit is what's driving it. I think it's because my books are in the Library of Congress. And okay. So if you were going to scrape a batch of texts and get them from one place, that's where you'd go. And there's even some talk around the Supreme Court just ruled that Donald Trump couldn't fire the librarian, not the librarian of Congress, who he did fire, but the person who's in charge of copyrights. And a lot of the it was a weird move that the administration did early on. And what they're realizing is the AI companies are driving it because they want access to the Library of Congress and everything in it and all the government databases. And this person is in charge of that. And this person was saying, no, we've got to have rules and checks and balances. And so basically, again, the Silicon Valley is lobbying Trump to get rid of that person so that we can have someone in there who can give us access to all this stuff. So it's not, the artists are, no one cares. No one, just like Spotify didn't consult us when they made the settlements with the record labels, right?
And well, that's what I was going to say. Did you read Mood Machine by Liz Pelly?
No, I haven't.
It's a book that's all about the shittiness of Spotify and its origin. And, you know, she goes into the fact that, like, even when they were starting, they didn't have copyright for anything. They just, like, took all the music without copyright and just started the platform before figuring that out.
Yeah. Well, if you understand the tech mantra, like the Silicon Valley mantra, is move fast and break things.
Right.
Their mantra is not like, oh, vet it with all the relevant stakeholders. That's not their mantra. So they and you know what's happening with Spotify is very. I'm looking at it a lot in what's happening with the AI in publishing. So I'm in both worlds. So with Spotify, they went out and they moved fast and they broke it and they just took everything. And then suddenly all the record companies were like, this is terrible. It's ruining artistry. They're stripping all the copyright from all these great artists. We're going to go out there and protect art. And then, of course, Spotify wrote them a check and they said, oh, nice check. We'll take that check. And basically they cut a deal that cut the artists out of it, right? Yeah. As famously, Spotify pays artists, even artists with tens of millions of streams, like pennies.
Yeah.
Right? So now with the AI, the publishing companies are in this position where they're like, we're going to protect art and artists and the integrity of literature. And everyone's kind of like, no. I think the artists are going to settle it themselves. The difference here is that writers own the copyright in most situations. So that's why Anthropic and their settlement is reaching out to individual. There's a class action and their individual authors are coming out. But, you know, what I'd like to see is every single one of these companies that are scraping all these books paying up. But, you know, they're all doing it. Anthropic is just the first one to get caught and settle. But, you know, anyone that has AI is using all the world's literature to power it. And so they're essentially violating the copyright of every writer whose books they're scraping. And they're scraping, like, everything. And so it's kind of a massive, like, situation, but they're counting on, hey, we're going to make so much money that either A, we're going to be able to settle, or B, we're going to lobby the government into saying that settling is not practical. So we're going to just sort of not honor those people's copyright. Because, of course, you know, the artists are way less organized than the tech bros are. So,
well, and it a lot of times feels like the artist, you know, is fighting against somebody who has a full-time job to do this thing, you know. Yeah. and this is like a side thing that we want to do to protect ourselves, but the main thing we want to do is make art. And it's like these other persons, like 40-hour-a-week, 60-hour-a-week job to like do this and screw us out of whatever we could get.
It's like, John, it's the theme of our whole talk today, right? Where it's like you have these people that are just trying to, you know, we make art so that we don't have to go over legal documents and like obsess over minutiae of terrible, boring things. We don't want to be that person. And then if you go back to high school, the people that were like, I'm not going to make something, I'm just going to make money off people that make something. Like, imagine who those people were in high school, right?
Right.
And they didn't hang around with us. They didn't hang around with the musicians and the poets and the creators. They were off doing their own thing. And so you have almost this whole other culture. And as soon as something, art magnetizes attention. And as soon as you get those eyeballs, everyone wants those eyeballs. That's how the entire algorithmic universe works. You get eyeballs on something and you charge advertisers dollars to access the eyeballs. Well, the thing that gets the most eyeballs because it's the most engaging is what? It's films, it's movies, it's music, it's books, it's Audible, it's podcasts, you know, all this content is really art and creativity, and it represents the life of people like you and me. But then there's whole other people whose lives are not that. Their lives are, how do I extract money from any situation, right? Mm-hmm. Any situation. Right. And so they always end up coming through. Like, we know their business plan because the Silicon Valley roadmap is what everyone has, which is create something, break something, disrupt a field, own the market, and then sell up for as much as you can, and then you're in the game.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Writing Podcast. Our show is a production of TW Media LLC based in Philadelphia and relies on listener support to keep podcasting and publishing written material. If you're interested in helping out, please consider becoming a paid subscriber on Substack or donating via the donate button on our RSS.com page or at talkingwriting.com/donate. As always, feel free to drop us a line at editor@talkingwriting.com. My daily, my daily, my daily.